The following message is by Dr. Jason DeRoshi, Research Professor of Old Testament and Biblical Theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and Content Developer and Global Trainer with Hands to the Plow Ministries. You can find more from Dr. DeRoshi at www.jasonderoshi.com.
So, I already noted in the Lord's Prayer, may your name be shown holy. We're praying that God would fulfill Ezekiel 36 in our lives and in the lives of those in his church. We've identified this, what a true Jew is. It's one who by the Spirit is transformed. And then we've elevated the missional task and identified it as fulfillment of exactly what Ezekiel was envisioning, that we would become witnesses of the living God in this world, from Jerusalem to Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. That's the fulfillment of Ezekiel's vision, that through you, I will vindicate the holiness of my great name in the sight of the nations, so that the nations may know Yahweh. Ezekiel 36. So I want you to recognize something, and we're going to highlight it a little bit more here, is that what Ezekiel is envisioning is that these people would be the very ones in whom the Spirit of God dwells, so that where they go, the presence of God is there. It's as if these people are envisioned in the new covenant are going to be movable temples, so that where they are, God is. Notice how Ezekiel talks in chapter 37. What does he envision? Dry bones, a dead Israel. And what does he anticipate is going to happen? Resurrection. We're going to talk more about this shortly, the significance of this reality within the book as a whole. But he's anticipating resurrection. And what does it look like? Verse 14, I will put my spirit within you and you shall live. And I will place you in your own land. Then you will know that I am Yahweh. I have spoken. What's envisioned next is the reunification of the people of God. He sees two sticks that God brings together, one Judah, one Israel. They become a reunited people. And then we read in verse 22, I will make them one nation in the land. We've already learned in Ezekiel 16 that this one nation will have daughters in the family, namely Samaria in the north and Sodom to the east. Built into this new family, this reunited Israel, will be some from the nations. But what does he say about them? I'll make them one nation on the mountains of Israel. One king shall be king over them. That's the shepherd from Ezekiel 34. And they shall no longer be two nations, but or divided kingdoms. They shall not defile themselves anymore with their idols and their detestable things, or with any of their transgressions, but I will save them from all their backslidings. This is a working out of Ezekiel 36, now associated directly with this new King David. All of their backslidings, all of their sinning will be pushed aside, and I will cleanse them, and they shall be my people. I will be their God. That's just a reassertion of what was said in Ezekiel 36. My servant David shall be king over them. They shall have one shepherd. They shall walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my statutes. They shall dwell in the land that I gave to my servant Jacob, where your fathers lived. They and their children and their children's children shall dwell there forever, and David, my servant, shall be their prince forever. Now, you might think, okay, dwelling in the land, Isn't that the promised land, Israel? Isn't that what God promised their fathers forever? Well, consider how the New Testament authors are going to use this text. I will make a covenant of peace with them. That's from Ezekiel 34. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. I'll set them in their land and multiply them. I will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. Notice that language of temple. God is going to set his presence in their midst forever. My dwelling shall be with them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And fulfillment of Ezekiel 36, the nations will know that I am the Lord who makes Israel holy when my sanctuary is in their midst forever. Now, if you've got your Bible, just turn over to 2 Corinthians 6:16. Paul cites this text and applies it to the church. Consider how he is envisioning this idea of God saying, I'm going to put my spirit in you and cause you to walk in my ways. Indeed, I'll put my spirit in you and you will live. I will make my sanctuary in your midst forever. Is this envisioning a future temple? A building after Jesus has already declared himself to be the temple and the church to be the temple? Well, Paul's going to cite this very text and apply it to the church as the temple of God. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16. Here it is. What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God. The church is God's temple. As God said, I will make my dwelling among them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. This is a blending of Leviticus 26:11 and Ezekiel 36. I will make my dwelling among them. I will be their God. They shall be my people. That is Ezekiel 36:27. And Paul is envisioning its fulfillment in the church. Hear that. When Ezekiel proclaims God's spirit will inhabit the hearts of his people, what he's envisioning is that those people are going to become the temple. And Paul is interpreting the text that way, that Jesus was the temple. And now Jesus goes to heaven in his body so that his spirit can be poured out upon his people. And now we are being built up, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2, built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets. Jesus Christ is the cornerstone, being shaped into the household of God where he dwells. I'm not trying to force the text anywhere. I'm saying I think Ezekiel envisioned this and Paul affirms it. Now we come to chapter 38 of Ezekiel. 38 and 39, where a power from the north called Gog, coming from Magog, is going to come down, and it's this vision, this image of ultimate evil. And God is declaring that he will one day overcome all that is evil. In a great eschatological battle, he will bring an end to what is evil and establish global peace for his remnant. Chapter 38, 16 and 17. You will come against my people Israel. Now, Israel has already been defined as a reunited people of God that is multi-ethnic in nature and associated with King David, and God's presence is in their midst. They're a resurrected people. You will come against my people Israel like a cloud covering the land. When will it happen? In the latter days. That phrase, latter days, we saw it already in Genesis 49. That's when the scepter will not depart from Judah in the latter days, and he'll crush the head of Moab. It's in the latter days that the star will rise from Jacob, says Numbers 24, and he will reign over all the earth. It's in the latter days, says Deuteronomy chapter 4, that God's people will return to the Lord because he will be compassionate or merciful to them. It's in the latter days, says Deuteronomy 31, that God will pour out his wrath on a rebellious Israel. It's in the latter days, we will see, says Hosea chapter 3, verse 5, that God will work his second exodus, drawing Israel out of exile, and they will follow Yahweh their God and David their king. Now we learn it's in the latter days that God will bring this enemy power, Gog, against my land, and the nations will know me. When through you, O Gog, I vindicate my holiness before their eyes. That is a twist to what we already read in Ezekiel 36, 22, and 23. In the one text, God's going to work through his people in such a way that his holiness will be displayed to the world. Here, God is going to destroy his enemy in such a way that he will make himself known to the world. Thus says the Lord God, are you he of whom I spoke in former days by my servants, the prophets of Israel, who in those days prophesied for years that I would bring you against them? So here's a question that a number of you asked in relation to Isaiah specifically. Isaiah 13 and 14 envisions the rise of Babylon and God's overcoming of Babylon. And a number of you asked, is this envisioning the actual Babylon of Jeremiah's day that overcame the 580 in 586 the Jerusalem? Or is this envisioning the eschatological ultimate Babylon that we see destroyed in the book of Revelation? And I believe the answer in that instance is yes. It's called typology, where a people or person or an institution or an event in the Old Testament is understood to create a pattern in history that will be escalated in space and time, culminating in relation to Jesus, where there is a pointer in the Old Testament. In this instance, it's the destruction of Babylon that was a foretelling of a greater plague that would come against God's people, and that God would intervene and destroy the enemy. According to verse 17, all of those predictions of an enemy coming against Israel was a foretaste of Gog. Gog is the ultimate image of that which is hostile to God. Now, what's intriguing is that back in Numbers 24, one of those early messianic prophecies that anticipate how a messianic king will give rise to new creation through a second exodus. The first exodus is talked about in chapter 23, where God led Israel out of the original Egypt. But now we envision in Numbers 24, in Balaam's third oracle, a future new king who will rise and, like a lion, lead Israel, lead a new people out of a new Egypt. Now, what I want to draw attention to there is that in that text, the enemy that is going to be destroyed is named Agag. In Numbers 24, Agag, who's connected with the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15. And for those who were with us last semester, Agag And the Amalekites were those that anticipated the book of Esther, because Haman was an Agagite and God had declared war against the Amalekites when they tried to destroy Israel. And so God is declaring that in the same way that the Amalekites tried to destroy God's son when they came out of Egypt, they were a picture of the serpent. And God is declaring he would ultimately overcome all of that evil hostility. And Agag is the king of the Amalekites and he embodies that. So it's possible that we're supposed to understand in Numbers 24 that Agag is a, that the name is predictive of that future king Agag in 1 Samuel 15, which itself is typological and predictive of who Haman is. But here's a unique element. Writing after the Old Testament is all done, the Septuagint translators, when they came to Numbers 24, did not translate the name Agag, who stands against this messianic king, and that the messianic king overcomes, didn't translate that name Agag in the Septuagint text. Rather, in the Greek, what it says is Gog. The messianic king will overcome Gog, which is exactly who's foretold here in Ezekiel 38. It's as if the Septuagint translator, already aware that Numbers 24 was a messianic text, reading that text in light of Ezekiel 38, is now identifying that Agag was merely a picture of Gog, and it's the change of a single letter. It's very, very small. And the translators identify theologically, we're talking about the same reality, the same evil that sought to destroy Israel in the wilderness, the same evil that Saul should have stood against, the same evil that sought to destroy the Jews in the days of Esther is embodied in this image of Gog. And the vision of Numbers 24 is that the Messiah will overcome him. Here we learn, are you not the one that the prophets proclaimed would stand against Israel long ago? And so it is that we come to Revelation 20, and in the text related to the thousand-year reign of Christ and the unleashing of the devil at the end of those years, the serpent, the devil, this is what we read. And when the thousand years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for the battle. The ESV leaves out the definite article, and I wish they would have kept it, because I believe John is envisioning a single climactic battle at the end of the age. He calls it the battle. And if you were to look back at chapter 19, verse 19, he speaks of the war, even though the ESV also leaves out the definite article there. It's in Revelation 16, 14, 17, 14, 19, 19, and in Revelation 20, verse 8, all of those texts speak of the same, the single culminating battle that's depicted in Ezekiel 38 and 39, and that is captured in texts like Zechariah 14. The war, the battle. It's all the same battle, not progressive, but rather talking about the same ultimate culminating event. At the end of the thousand years, there is going to be a battle, Gog and Magog, these images of evil from the book of Ezekiel, images that are here related to that serpent of old, are now brought together. God will gather them for battle, for the battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea, and they marched up over the broad plain of the earth. They surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven in that moment and consumed them. And the devil who had devoured them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where also the beast and the prophet were. throne, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Ezekiel is anticipating in this movement through envisioning exile unto resurrection, that is death unto resurrection, envisioning after exile, the people of God being reborn, God entering into an everlasting covenant, the new David rising, and then at the end of the age, a culminating battle against evil. And that ends his proclamation section. And it moves us into a final section, restoration envisioned.
Dr. DeRozan.
Now, I did some work this morning, and so all of this is not in your handout, but I'm happy to repost this PowerPoint in its new form for all of you. So here's the basic structure. You've got a four-verse preamble. Then Yahweh establishes his residence in the temple. Israel responds to his presence in their midst. And then Yahweh appoints the healed land to his transformed Israel, the transformed 12 tribes. Turn with me to Ezekiel chapter 40 as we consider this text. We have to read it, I believe, as we enter into a visionary account. We have to constantly be thinking, okay, this is visions. That's what it says. Visions about this temple and land. And we have to read it in light of the proclaimed declarations that have already come earlier. What is already clear should inform our reading of the end of this book. And so what we read is, in the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was struck down, on that very day, the hand of Yahweh was upon me, and he brought me to the city. But I wish the ESV wouldn't have rendered it that way, because in the very next verse, it's going to say, he brought me to a structure like a city. And what really the Hebrew just says, he brought me to there. Where? Where? At this point, Ezekiel doesn't tell us the name of the city. In fact, in the rest of these chapters, he never defines it until we get to the end of the book, the very last verse. Now it says, and this place where God has chosen to remake his presence known, where God has chosen to dwell, the name of that place is Yahweh is there. Yahweh Shema, Yahweh is there. That's the name that Ezekiel gives. So he brought me to there. That is, in visions of God, he brought me to the land of Israel and set me down on a very high mountain. Something that is similar to the language of a text like Isaiah chapter 2. But as we're going to see, he's already talked in these terms. He's already mentioned a high mountain in his predictions. He brought me and placed me on a very high mountain on which was a structure like a city to the south. So there's a mountain with a city. And that's already, he's talking in language that's similar to the Garden of Eden. There's a garden in Eden from which flows a river that breaks into four channels. That means the water's flowing down, and as is common all throughout the Old Testament and the ancient world, Yahweh's throne, or the throne of the gods, is always depicted on the top of a mountain. And here, it's a very high mountain. And Yahweh's city is there. And it's from there that he's going to reign and dwell. Notice it's in visions of God. It's a very high mountain. It's a structure like a city. And then what we find out is Ezekiel is not like those that were in Moses' audience. The majority of them, God has not given you eyes to see or ears to hear or a heart to know. That's Deuteronomy 29, verse 4. Here, what we read in verse 4 is, "And the man said to me, Son of man, look, see with your eyes, hear with your ears, set your heart upon all that I will show you." Ezekiel is a regenerated man who's not spiritually disabled. He has eyes to see and a mind to understand that which God is disclosing. So that's the basic structure. Now, as we look at this text, I think there are numerous clues that we are not to read this as a future physical temple, and that Ezekiel's audience wouldn't, that the remnant nor Ezekiel himself understood that this was building plans for something in the future. Let me just walk through this list. Elements that suggest Ezekiel's vision represents something other than a future physical temple. Well, before the visions, Ezekiel has already proclaimed that God's people would be the very ones in whom God would dwell. And as we already saw from 2 Corinthians 6:16, Paul says we're talking about the people as a temple. And now we have a visionary account of God coming and making his inhabitation in Israel, where will dwell his people. Now, Ezekiel had already spoken of an eschatological high mountain associated with God's new covenant work. So let's just turn our Bibles back to Ezekiel 17, 22. First place in the book where we read about this. "Thus says the Lord God, I myself will take a sprig from the lofty top of the cedar and will set it out. I will break off from the topmost of its twigs a tender one, and I myself will plant it on a high and lofty mountain. On that mountain height of Israel, I will plant it." It's going to be like a new creational garden that I will, that it may bear branches and produce fruit and become a noble cedar. And under it will dwell every kind of bird, a full new creation. In the shade of its branches, birds of every sort will nest. And all the trees of the field shall know that I am Yahweh. I bring low the high tree. I make high the low tree, dry up the green tree and make the dry tree flourish. I am the Lord. Now, when you read that, about the high mountain and the tree, probably in your mind, you don't have a trouble reading that in symbolic terms and associating it with the new covenant. Well, I'm proposing that the language of the high mountain at the end of the book is exactly the same way. More significant, go to chapter 20, 40 through 41, a chapter we'll return to at the end of this lecture. Verse 40. "On my holy mountain, the mountain height of Israel, declares the Lord Yahweh, there all the house of Israel, all of them, shall serve me in the land. There I will accept them. There I will require your contributions and the choicest of your gifts with all your sacred offerings. As a pleasing aroma, I will accept you. When I bring you out from the peoples, I will gather you out of all your countries where you've been scattered, and I will manifest my holiness among you in the sight of the nations." That text is anticipating what we already read about in Ezekiel 36, and it associates it with God's high and holy mountain. And I'm proposing that it's a clue within the book that when he's talking now about the high and holy mountain, he's envisioning comparable realities that he already spoke about in Ezekiel 36 and 37. Ezekiel portrays the growing river that flows from the sanctuary. He portrays it in Edenic and in messianic terms. And then John is going to draw on this text and identify it with the new Jerusalem. So let's consider that. Ezekiel 47, 1 through 12. We're not going to read the whole text. We'll just come down to verse 8. "This water that is flowing from the great sanctuary, it flows toward the eastern region, goes down into the Arabah and enters the Dead Sea. Where the water flows into the sea, the water becomes fresh. It takes that which was putrid First, the waters flow from Jerusalem all the way down to the Dead Sea. That's fascinating imagery of this new Jerusalem and this new creation that is being birthed. And even the waters that have been associated since the days of Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot with saltiness so that nothing could live in the Dead Sea region, now the waters are going to flow down there and it's going to make the very waters themselves pure, such that fishermen will stand beside the sea. I love when the new creation texts envision fishing. That I love that. It's one of my happy places. There will be fishermen standing beside the sea from En Gedi to En Goliam. It will be a place for the spreading of nets. Its fish will be of very many kinds, like the fish of the great sea. He's using imagery to identify how curse will be overcome and it will be a flourishing place of new creation. But then he notes this: but its swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They are to be left for salt. Now that's striking, because what it suggests is that in the new creation, there is still going to be remnants, that is, reminders of the old creation. They will be minor, but that salt was part of the curse. It's the only reason you remember that in the days of Abraham and Lot, when Lot chose to go down into the valley, it says in the text, this was before God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. The Dead Sea, according to the text, only arose after God made Lot's wife a pillar of salt and poured out fire and sulfur down on Sodom and Gomorrah at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. It is in that day that the sea was bound up and all the minerals flow in, but there's no place for them to flow out. It is the lowest place on the earth's crust. You can't get any closer to the earth's core than at the Dead Sea. And it's been a picture since those days of Lot of ultimate curse and destruction. In the new creation, the vision is that all of that curse will be overcome, but there will still be reminders. Indeed, they'll probably use the salt for cooking and cleansing. But it's not just that the salt is there as a reminder of what was. In the same way, I proposed that part of New Covenant grace is that you and I will ever remember the sinfulness of who we were. In the same way that Revelation 5 and 7 suggest that the languages that grew out of the curse at the Tower of Babel will be preserved, but they've been overcome, yet will be an ever-present reminder of the seriousness of curse, and yet transformed and now used by God to proclaim his greatness. Then the last verse, verse 12, and on the banks of that river, on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruit fail, but they will bear fresh fruit every month because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for fruit, food, and their leaves for healing. Their leaves will not wither. That only occurs one other time in all the Old Testament. Anybody know where it is?
Psalm 1.
The man. Oh, the blessed state of the man. And blessed are those who take refuge in him. The blessed state of the man whose life is grounded in the book. He's like a tree planted by streams of water. He meditates on the law day and night, like Joshua was called to do. Joshua, who would lead Israel into the promised land, whose life would flourish if he would but heed the voice. Now, this vision is that the man is a new Joshua, as we're going to see, and he's planted by the streams, and his life is like new creation. His leaf does not wither, and whatever he does prospers. Ezekiel is portraying this new creation in messianic terms. It's as if the work of the Messiah is accomplished, and now it's spreading. Wherever the waters of life flow out of this new garden, Things are being transformed, fruit for food and leaves for healing. And now we come to Revelation. Revelation chapter 22 uses this exact language. Then the angel showed me the river of the waters of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the house of God and the throne of God and the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city. Also on either side of the river, the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. That's Ezekiel 47, verse 12. Fruit for food, leaves for healing. This is how, this whatever Ezekiel is envisioning, I believe it is directly related to what John is seeing fulfilled. And we've already seen that what Ezekiel is proclaiming in Ezekiel 37, Paul sees as being fulfilled in the church. As you look at the details of the text, the city is idealized. It is a perfect square with three gates on each side for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, John in Revelation 21 notes this, and there were 12 gates with 12 pearls. Each of the gates made a single pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, transparent as glass. I saw no temple, for its temple is the Lord, the God Almighty. And the city, so there's 12 gates, and I thought John said more, but he, as best as I can see right as I'm glancing, it doesn't look like he says more than that. There's 12 gates in John's city. There's 12 gates in Ezekiel's city, and both of them entail a symmetry. But for John, it's a square city. For Ezekiel, it's a square city. For John, it's not only a square, it includes one more dimension, a height. And what's an intriguing element is that if you work through Ezekiel, I'll note this in the last point, and you see what is measured with the measuring stick, he only measures widths. He doesn't measure heights. And it's intriguing because it suggests to me he's not making a blueprint of something that can be recreated. And it raises the question, why does he focus on width and not height? He has walls that are massively thick, walls that are perfectly symmetrical. And I think all of it is designed to highlight the holiness of the God who dwells within. The holiness of the God that has been taken lightly. But in John, we don't have a square city. Instead, we have a cubed city. And there is no temple. And the reason there's no temple is because the temple by nature separates what's holy from what is common. And there's gradations of sacred space. But in John's vision, which I think is complementary to Ezekiel's, it's not identical to it, but it's complementary to it and even uses similar imagery in order to show that they're tied together and I believe are talking about the same thing. For John, speaking about a cubed city, there is only one other cube in all the Bible. Where is that cube? What else is that cube? I think we talked about this in class. Anybody?
The Holy of Holies.
That's it. It's the only other cube that we read about. And the reason there is no temple is because in John's vision, all of reality has become the Holy of Holies. And building off of Jeremiah, you and I are the image in God's temple. We are the Ark of the Covenant in whose hearts are the law. And on us, God and the Lamb reign. That is John's vision. And it's not a new creation with a city. It's a new creational city where the city has become all. The garden has become all. That, I believe, is what John is envisioning. The apportionment of the land significantly disregards topographical and historical realities. It's just stretched out in direct lines all the way over the scope of the promised land where the 12 tribes are going to be. And it's strange in the way that he talks about it. You can see a picture of it in my notes. The city and the temple dimensions are dominated by multiples of five, with 25 being the dominant number. The measuring rod is only used for horizontal measurements, thus cutting against the idea of reconstruction, yet highlighting the greatness of Yahweh's holiness. John 2 speaks of one who has a measuring rod to measure the city in order to highlight, I believe, the vast holiness and the perfect symmetry of that holiness of God. So here's a handful of parallels with Revelation 21 and 22. A visionary transport of the prophet to a high mountain happens in both texts. The site of a new world with Jerusalem at the center happens in both texts, though I would suggest Revelation, these are straight out of Block's article that I mentioned at the beginning of the notes, and you can read it. But I would suggest against Block that indeed Jerusalem is being portrayed not at the center of the city, but as the city. Jerusalem is the bride. It is everything. It is the new creation, the dwelling of God in the midst of the people, which produces a state of perfect well-being, the presence of God's glory in the city, the heavenly interpreter with a measuring rod to measure the city, a symmetrical plan of the city complete with high walls and 12 gates, one for each of the tribes, an emphasis on purity and holiness of those within, the presence of a river. With respect to the city itself, in Ezekiel, the city is unnamed. In Revelation, it's the New Jerusalem. In Ezekiel, you only see it described as a square. In Revelation, it's a cube, which aren't against each other per se, but nevertheless distinct. In Ezekiel, it appears as though it's ordinary stones, though it's not specified. In Revelation, it's clear it's precious stones. The temple's role, it's at the center of everything. Whereas in Revelation, it's not a distinct element, but is everything, I add. The role of sacrifice is at the heart of all that's happening in Ezekiel's temple. Whereas in Revelation, the sacrificial yet victorious lamb lives among his people. He's also at the center of everything, both in the worship that's being brought to him and in the symbol that he represents as the substitute. There's the continuing need to distinguish pure and impure in Ezekiel's vision, whereas in Revelation, everything has been made absolutely pure. The scope of Ezekiel's vision is Israelite. It's talking about the land, but already, I'll qualify that, he's already talked about an international inclusion into Israel, but still his focus is on Israel as a nation and God remaking that nation. In Revelation, the scope is universal and focused on global realities of the world. I think all of these distinctions simply highlight that these two are not looking at the same symbolic representation, but they are looking at a comparable representation. And John goes out of his way to identify that we're talking about the same thing. And what they're talking about is what was already proclaimed at the beginning of the, at the earlier part of the book, namely that the people of God are going to become the temple of God. And one day all evil will be eradicated such that that temple will not have any distinguishing marks between the holy and the common, but we will all, with that curtain removed, be dwelling in the Holy of Holies. And the Holy of Holies will have, in the same way that the Ark of the Covenant will be not remembered, but God's presence will be over Jerusalem, says Jeremiah chapter 3. And in Jerusalem will be gathered people from all the nations whose hearts will no longer go against God. It's exactly that same image. This is envisioning an eschatological new creation that where the city of God and the land of God have become the center of reality. And in that reality, the city of God and the land of God are enjoying the presence of God. The people of God are there. The messianic element overtones are present. New creation is blooming. The nations are there. It's for the healing of the nations. That's what's going on there. So I'll just summarize and then we'll take some time for questions. Turn with me back to Ezekiel 20. I'm just going to summarize this book for us as I understand it working its way out. Ezekiel 20 is an overview of Israel's history. And it walks through the history in the Pentateuch and sets us up for understanding Ezekiel's exilic context of death. You'll recall that in Leviticus 18:5, a text very familiar to Paul, and he cites it two different times to talk about the death-dealing, death-bringing nature of the Old Covenant. He says, "You shall therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, he shall live by them." If you do the law, you'll live. Or in Paul's words, in Romans chapter 7, verse 10, the law that promised life to me ultimately brought death. Why? Because I couldn't keep the law. So notice with me in Ezekiel chapter 20, we're going to begin in verse 8. Israel rebelled against me in Egypt, and were not willing to listen to me. None of them cast away the detestable things their eyes feasted on, nor did they forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said, I'll pour out my wrath upon them and spend my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. But I acted for the sake of my name, that it should not be profaned in the sight of the nations among whom they lived, in whose sight I made myself known to them, in bringing them out of the land of Egypt. So I led them out of the land of Egypt, and I brought them into the wilderness. Notice when it happened, I gave them statutes and made known to them my rules, by which if a person does them, he shall live. What are we talking about? We're talking about the Book of the Covenant in Exodus 20 through 23. We're talking about the book of Leviticus, where this passage comes from. This is the use of the Old Testament in the Old Testament. Ezekiel is citing Leviticus 18:5. Oh, had they kept the Mosaic covenant, they would have lived. Then we read in verses 13 and 14, but the house of Israel rebelled in the wilderness. So they left Mount Sinai, they rebel in the wilderness, they did not walk in my statutes, but rejected my rules, by which if a person does them, he shall live. And my Sabbaths they greatly profaned. Then I said, I'll pour out my wrath on them in the wilderness to make a full end of them. But I acted for the sake of my holy name, that it should not be profaned in the sight of the nations, in whose sight I brought them out. And what did God do? He raised up a new generation in the wilderness. He led them through that wilderness, and he gave them a fresh opportunity. But the children, verse 21, but the children of Israel rebelled. They did not walk in my statutes. They were not careful to obey my rules, by which if a person does them, he shall live. That's the story of Israel in the Pentateuch. What comes next? God gives them Deuteronomy. And that's why we read in verse 25, I gave them statutes that were not good and rules by which they could not have life. That's what Deuteronomy is. It ultimately, it killed them. But it wasn't ultimately because the law was bad. I think he's speaking rhetorically here. It's that the law was, in God's sovereign plan, intended to destroy Israel. This is what happened to them. And Ezekiel is now living in a day where the law, had they obeyed it, they could have lived. It's resulted in something else. It's resulted in Ezekiel 37. Because Israel rebelled, we read in Ezekiel 37, this. The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out into by the Spirit and set me down in the middle of the valley. It was full of bones. And he led me around among them, and behold, there were many, many bones on the surface of the valley, and behold, they were very dry. This is where Israel has come. If a person does them, he will live. And Ezekiel is speaking to a people who have not lived. They have died. The old covenant, in Paul's words, bore a ministry of death and condemnation, 2 Corinthians 3:7-9. That would stand in contrast to the new covenant that would bear a ministry of righteousness. So it is that in this context of death, God gives this vision of resurrection, of new life, and with that, a new temple. The old temple, the shadow, would come to an end and be replaced with a temple not made with hands, says the writer of Hebrews. The old covenant is associated with Jerusalem that is below. But we, for us who are in the new covenant, Jerusalem that is above is our mother. Galatians chapter 4, 25 and 26. God would perform a resurrection, making the people a movable temple. 3:14, I'll put my spirit within you and you shall live. Or verses 27 and 28, my dwelling shall be with them. I will be their God. They will be my people. They will be the temple of God, as Paul says explicitly in 2 Corinthians 6:16. This temple will be a perfectly obedient temple. That is because the law will have been written on their hearts. That is because they'll have the heart of stone moved out and a new heart put in, and the Spirit will be breathing upon them. They will be true imagers of God. They'll be like the Ark of the Covenant, truly putting on display the holy character of God. They'll be an open book, though, that everyone who enters in will be able to read. And they'll be ruled, it says, by a new David. So verse 23, I will save them from all their backsliding, and I will cleanse them. And then my servant David shall be king over them, and they shall all have one shepherd. They shall walk in my rules and shall be careful to obey my statutes. They're going to follow this new David, the Spirit working in them, and they will live in a restored Eden. That is, God's presence will be with them. Or, as it says explicitly in 36:35, and they will say, all those who pass by this newly transformed, restored Israel, this land was desolate, that was desolate, has become like the Garden of Eden, and the waste and desolate and ruined cities are now fortified and inhabited. Do you believe that when people see you, they are seeing evidence of new creation, that the branch of God is beginning to bloom, that you who have taken refuge in the new David are yourself beginning to branch out like Jeremiah 24 said would happen? Do you believe that you're the temple of the present, of the very living God, and that this calls you to holiness? Do you believe that you're the temple of the living God, filled with his Spirit, such that you have the power to pursue holiness? Do you grieve over sin as evidence of new covenant grace working in your life? Ezekiel envisioned a reunited Israel under the Davidic king, including some from the nations. Ezekiel envisioned God's people feeling remorse over previous sins. Ezekiel envisioned the Spirit bringing life, resulting in covenant keeping. He envisioned God cleansing his people from all their desire and sin, evil desire and sin. He envisioned God being with his people as a temple, overseeing them forever. He envisioned a new Eden-like creation. He envisioned God's overcoming enemies and protecting his people during the Messiah's reign. So I summarize, after Judah's rebellion results in Babylon destroying Yahweh's temple throne in the earthly Jerusalem, the sovereign God will reestablish his reign through the new David by returning Israel to its homeland, by indwelling his people by his spirit, resulting in them being a temple that displays his holiness, and by defeating all the enemies so that the world will know that Yahweh is the true God. That's what I got for Ezekiel. Questions from you folks.
Dr. DeRouche, I have a question for you. I've been reading over through the book of Romans, and in Romans 10, Paul says that he goes through that rhetorical list of questions by which someone can be saved, the necessary events, and Paul says the Jews have always heard the gospel, but yet in that line of rhetorical questions, their argument is that they've never heard the gospel, that this has never been told to them. And then he quotes several Old Testament scriptures showing that the gospel has gone forth to the ends of the world. And he testifies about Moses to them. But how can the Jewish people say that they have never heard the gospel like this when we read passages like Ezekiel's new temple of the Messiah, the new covenant in Jeremiah? How can the Jews say they've never heard the gospel when we have language like this riddled throughout?
What is at stake is a deaf person has ears in their head but can't hear. And a blind person sees much but can't see. Sees much. Spiritually blind person sees much but can't see. So just think about a handful of texts. You have seen all that I did to the Egyptians, the great signs and the wonders that I did against them in Egypt. But to this day, Deuteronomy 29:4, God has not given you a heart to know or eyes to see or ears to hear. Israel was ignorant of God's ways, blind to his beauty, and deaf to his will, even though they had seen his power through the Exodus and encountered him at Mount Sinai. And the result was their rebellion. As we're going to see in the book of Isaiah, part of God's judgment against Israel was not simply that he didn't overcome their deafness. Sin is not only worthy of judgment, sin often is judgment. God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that would not see, ears that would not hear, down to this very day, says Paul in Romans 11, verse 8. And he's citing there Isaiah 29. Isaiah 29 reads this way. Astonish yourselves and be astonished. Blind yourselves and be blind. Be drunk, but not with wine. Stagger, but not with strong drink. For the Lord has poured out upon you a spirit of deep sleep. He's closed your eyes. He's covered your heads. And the vision of all this has become to you like the words of a book that is sealed, so that when men give it to one who can read and they say, read this, he says, I can't read it. It's sealed. That's your Jews. Or when they give the book to one who cannot read, and they say, read this, he says, I cannot read it. It's right there in the scroll, and yet he is not responsive to it. He cannot encounter it in a way that's changing his life. But just a few verses later, in verse 18, it says, in that future day of transformation, the deaf will hear the words of a book, and out of their gloom and darkness, the eyes of the blind will see. That's the new covenant hope. When Isaiah, which was the same for us as it was for them, meaning the book hasn't changed, But all of a sudden, with the coming of Christ, something has changed. Two other texts, 2 Corinthians chapter 3, 14. 2 Corinthians 3, 14. What does Paul say? Their minds, that is the Jews' minds, and it would be, well, their minds were hardened, for to this day, that to this day, that little phrase, to this day, I believe is an allusion to Deuteronomy 29, verse 4. To this day, God has not given you eyes to see, ears to hear, a heart to know. And what Paul is saying is that the days of Moses have continued all the way to this day. And I would suggest, just like you're proposing, that most Jews to this day still have hardness and blindness. Their minds were hardened, for to this day, when they read the Old Covenant, that same veil remains unlifted so that they can't see the glory of God. They can't understand how the Old Covenant points to Jesus, because only through Christ is that veil removed. Second text, Romans 16, 25. Romans 16, 25. And this is very significant. You remember how Romans begins with the gospel. The gospel of God that was promised beforehand by the prophets in the sacred writings concerning the Son. Well, now he ends his book this way. To him who is able to strengthen you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ. The gospel that was promised beforehand in the prophets. Your question, why can't the Jews see it? The gospel of Paul and the preaching of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery that was kept secret for long ages, but has now been disclosed and through the prophetic writings has been made known to all nations. For ages, even up to the present, for so many Jews, there has been a secret hidden, a mystery kept secret for long ages. But in the coming of Christ, a mystery is revealed. But that mystery is being disclosed in the very Old Testament, where the secret was kept. And yet they read it and they don't have eyes to see. This is why God told Isaiah in Isaiah 30, verse 8, he said, now go, write what I'm telling you on a tablet, inscribe it in a scroll, that it may be for a time to come as a witness forever. That time to come is now, when God has allowed people from all the nations to have ears to hear and eyes to see what Isaiah intended all along, what he wrote, what he proclaimed, what Ezekiel was describing. We're not bringing a special code to the text. It was there all the while. The very prophets who prophesied concerning the gospel are where we're finding our answers. And we're not going outside of them. We're finding it right in the text. And yet, what we've been given is a lens. And that lens is Christ. And we have light, and that light is Christ. And most of the truths of the Old Testament, I believe, were already known by the biblical authors themselves. There's at least one example explicitly where the Old Testament author did not understand what he was writing about. Daniel chapter 12. I don't understand. Go your way. It's not for you to understand. It's for days to come. Our days, where we can understand Daniel even better than Daniel understood Daniel. But for most of the prophecies, I believe the Old Testament prophets, they searched and inquired carefully, and they knew something about the person and about the time. And yet their audiences are just like modern Jews today who fail to surrender to Jesus. But when God enters in, the very one who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," shines into our hearts and gives us the light of the gospel, of the glory of God in the face of Christ. When we see God through Christ, all of a sudden something is unlocked. So there's continuity, meaning that what we're declaring is exactly what's in the Old Testament, but there's discontinuity in that a mystery has been revealed, in that when you put Christ in the foreground, all of a sudden there's clarity that wasn't there before. That's what I got.
Thank you for listening to this message from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter their content in any way without written permission from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. For more writings, sermons, and lectures from Dr. DeRoshi, please visit www.jasonderoshi.com. Proclaiming the kingdom and treasuring the God who reigns, saves, and satisfies through covenant for his glory in Christ.